It's 1:30, so let's convene the virtual meeting of the Clallam County PUD for August the 10th, 2020. So we'll call this meeting to order. And the first item, by the way, is Dave on?
Yep, I can see him.
Okay. So the first item is approval of the consent agenda. We have minutes from the July 27th meeting. Claim vouchers for July 27th through August the 3rd. We have payroll vouchers for the period July 1 through July 15th. Removal of delinquent accounts from the August active accounts receivable in the total amount of $5,098.75. So are any questions on that?
Yeah, this is Jim. I got a couple questions on the invoices. Just explanation, I don't understand what it means. In one of them, there's a $10,774 bill to something called Clear Assault, and it's for program services. You know what that is?
Yeah, let me look at that, Jim, and see if Steve or any of the others, Sean, whether you guys recognize that.
It's an alphabetical order, so it's clear. It's, I guess, clear result or something like that. Clear result.
Right.
Sounds like janitorial supplies.
For $10,000?
Well, we got to keep it clean, Jim.
Well, it doesn't say toilet services. It says program services now. Are we calling janitorial programs services now?
I was just speculating. I'm not sure.
All right. Okay.
Steve, you have any idea on this one?
No, I do not. I don't remember what that was. If it's an IT program, if it's actually software, I'm not sure.
Well, we can come back.
I can find out.
The answer, if that's okay with Jim.
The clear result is for our program for LED light bulbs with like Walmart and Home Depot.
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. That makes sense. All right. That's all I got.
Yeah, I had one question, which is just kind of a minor thing, but there's a charge for Green Crow Investments LLC. I thought they were mainly involved in real estate. It's only $500. I don't. It must be some service there that they rendered us.
Will, this is John. That is actually for a right of way.
Ah, okay. All right, that makes sense.
With Green Crow.
Green Crow, yeah. All right, any other questions? Do we have a motion?
Dave, you're muted there, Dave. Dave, you're muted. There you go.
Okay, now you can hear me?
Yep, we can hear you now.
There he is.
Okay. Yeah, I must have unintentionally got muted. Anyhow, I move that we approve the consent agenda, which includes the minutes of the July 27th, 2020 regular meeting, claim vouchers July 27th and August 3rd for a total of $2,711.15.29. Payroll vouchers for the period July 1 through July 15th, and removal of delinquent accounts from the August active accounts receivable in a total amount of $5,098.75, including a 30% collection fee.
This is Jim. I will second that.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded to approve the consent agenda of August the 10th, 2020. All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Okay, thank you. Agenda revisions, anything, Doug?
No, nothing today.
Anything from the board?
Maybe. Maybe you guys got it in there someplace, but I'd like to talk a bit. I'm going to bring it up. In the WAPAG meeting, there was some discussion about BPAs changing their approach on secondary sales, and I'd like some feedback. I guess, Sean, and you were on that call, too, so I want to talk a bit about that, and I can just do it someplace. But
yeah, just maybe in commissioner reports, huh?
Yeah, as long as Sean's prepared to talk about it.
Okay, good. All right, comments from the public.
Will, we received an email from Christine Reed this morning asking two questions. I'm just going to read them here if you don't mind.
Okay.
The first question is, can you provide the name of the consulting firm that was contracted by Energy Northwest to create a new resource adequacy analysis? And is there an anticipated submission date? And the second question is, what is the plan for representation for our PUD during the next BPA rate case negotiations? I could probably quickly answer number two, Will, but number one, I would have to defer to the board.
It'll be a quick answer. There's really nothing to report on that. There's been no contracts let. This is being done as part of the Business Development Fund by EDS. And the no contracts been let. And this is going to be a long-term study, so we'll just have to come back and revisit that. So nothing to report at this point.
On the number two, Will, do you want me just to give a brief answer to that one, too?
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Okay, well, the first part of the question is asking for representation. And so basically for rate case and contracts, it would be the general manager, the assistant general manager, the power analyst, and myself. The commission is obviously also involved anything to do related with contracts and BPA. The second part of that is has to do with negotiations, and actually the rate case isn't a negotiation. It's the development of electricity prices to meet revenue requirements from Bonneville. And so the negotiation would come into play during the 2028 contract expiration.
Okay.
So outside of that, if there's any other customers who would like to make a comment, just go ahead and give me your first name and I'll go in order. Hearing none, Will.
Thank you. Our next item is a business item. We only have one. This is Resolution 2179-20, authorizing the disposal of surplus property. Terry, I think you have that one.
Yes, that's right. Hi, this is Terry Lind, Operations Superintendent for the Port Angeles Service Area, including the auto shop. Staff requests that the Commission pass Resolution Number 2179-20, authorizing the disposal of vehicles and equipment identified in the list provided in the board packet. The total estimated value is $14,150.
Okay.
Now, on your screen now, you should see the list. Please let me know if you have any questions. We plan to auction the surplus items through govdeals.com, as we have done previously.
Well, I don't see it on the screen, but we have it in front of us, I think.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, I see you're doing screen sharing. Okay, good.
And I'd be glad to answer any questions if anybody has any.
Well, huh. So this is all mainly vehicles, high mileage, high maintenance costs, which you've looked at. And so we need to replace this or dispose of these items.
Yes, that is correct. These items, these vehicles and equipment have all been replaced. They've actually even been used in a secondary role for some time. And they've pretty much each of them have just reached the end of their valuable life to the district, and we feel it's time to get rid of them.
Yeah. What about that trailer there? It's 1991. It's quite old.
It is, yeah. And we aren't using it, haven't been using it for quite a little while. It was used by the water department since 91. And when they replaced that trailer, we used it for a while, filling other needs, and just really don't have a need for it now, and thought we would get rid of it at auction while it still has some value.
Okay, sounds good. Any comments?
I don't have any comments.
No comments.
Okay, do we have a motion?
Yeah, I move that we approve Resolution 2179-20, authorizing the disposal of the surplus property listed in the screen there. I'll go through it all, but the total estimated value of the surplus property is $14,500. It will be auctioned off through governmentdeals.com.
I'll second that.
Been moved and seconded for approval of Resolution 2179-20, authorizing the disposal of surplus property on the list dated, August 10th, 2020, with a estimated value of surplus property is $14,500. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Okay, so much for business items. Correspondence communication. Doug, do we have anything?
Doug, you're muted.
No, Will, not today.
Okay, great. All right, commissioner reports.
Yeah, okay, I'll start out here. Attended the Western Public Agencies Group meeting on the 30th, WAPEG. I don't go into the secondary issues since I think Jim's going to cover that, but as usual in the WAPEG meetings, we cover a wide range of issues, so I'll just go into the integrated program review comments, the IPR comments that were submitted to BPA on the 31st. We had the meeting on the 30th, so that was the last chance for any additional comments to be made. So after that meeting, then the any revisions that were made were incorporated, and they were sent to Bonneville on Friday the 31st. So the primary comments were, first was to suspend the FRP surcharge. This is a surcharge that's been pushed out due to the COVID virus to help the budgets of utilities that are subject to it. The suggestion is to just suspend it completely, and that'll leave $80 million in communities that are dealing with the COVID budget issues without impacting the EPA cost recovery that's needed. Second item was to seek additional fish and wildlife program savings. Looking like with the EIS, it's a good time to review all the different components of that program and just determine which ones are effective and are necessary from a scientific and cost standpoint. Also look at the offsets for financial and operational impact for the increased spill requirements that have been put in place recently. Third item was for hydro to identify additional savings where possible. One issue that seems to keep coming up is that the previous capital program that BPA has in place for the hydro capital projects was $200 million, and they weren't even able to spend all that. Now they want to increase that to $300 million. So the suggestion is to reject that number and recommend perhaps no more than $250 million going forward for capital projects. Next item was Energy Northwest. And I think the main thing there is to just continue the asset management that has been done on the Columbia Generating Station, which is not being done so much on the hydro infrastructure. Other issues in there were the information technology. They want to increase the budget by $17 million a year, and it's recommended that they take a closer look at that and look at, you know, ways to save money on IT compared to what they're planning there. The other thing is for the Vancouver Control Center to take a closer look at that and come up with a revised plan. So those are the six items that were forwarded to VPA as comments from the Western Public Agencies Group, which most of the members of that group are west of the Cascades, primarily in Washington, but also in Oregon. I think Kittitas and one other Eastern Washington utilities member, but it's mostly utilities that are west of the Cascades. So that's all that I have for today.
Okay, Jim, you got, I'm muted or not? Where am I?
Okay, here we go. I'll fill in a couple things on WAPAG. One thing, Dave mentioned asset management at Columbia Generating Station versus Hydro, and I brought this point up and also talked to Ryan a bit about it. I've been trying to figure out what they really mean by asset management at Bonneville Power, and they're using the ISO 55000 standard, which is a good standard and so forth, but it's very rigorous, and it depends on how you apply it. The way they're applying it, though, is kind of really interesting. They have set up 9,000 different items to asset manage. And so this could be anything from a little pump someplace to a turbine to an exciter to all kind of little things, a vehicle. But the problem is that they don't roll these things up into a project like a dam like they do at Columbia Generating Station. And so DPA doesn't really have a way to accurately or within in the normal way that you would estimate something, a bottoms-up estimate of what a project like a dam or hydro system or not the system but a specific project would cost. And so this is, I think, part of the challenge they're having is that BPA is they don't have a good handle on that. And so a lot of their costs are modeled. Their revenue, of course, is modeled on things like flows and secondary sales, the same thing, even more so. And so we've just got a ton of assumptions going into models that for BPA to basically is using to develop their revenue stream as well as their cost information on the hydro system. So that makes it difficult for them to frankly understand this. Now, the Corps of Engineers has those numbers, and I've been able to get those numbers through FOIA requests and so forth. And by getting those numbers, I can see that BPA is underestimating cost on dams in general, and specifically in Lower Snake Dams. So anyway, I brought that up. Now, the other one is the secondary sales. BPA is proposing a different way of calculating, not calculating, that's all modeled, but applying the model results of secondary sales. And basically what they want to do is lowball the basic estimate on secondary sales. And so, because they've been overshooting for years now. And but what that does is it basically lowers their cash reserves and so forth. And the idea being they want to, it's like a, you know, do a good news. They don't like the bad news, good news. They want to make a good news, bad news or whatever. Reverse the flip the order of this thing. And the idea being that they'll give us good news later on and give us money back. They'll say, okay, we underestimated secondary sales. It came in higher. Therefore, we've got more cash reserves. Therefore, we can give you a credit back. People in that WAPAG call are generally skeptical, some of them, of that idea, and we should be, because it's like basically you end up having to raise rates now on the promise that they'll go down later, or you'll get a rebate later or credit or something like that. So that's one that the WAPAG folks and I think the people on that call will be watching pretty closely. Now, Sean, I don't know if you had any comments on that. What's your view on that as well, or anybody else that was listening in? But that's what I was looking for the staff, some feedback on that.
We verified with BPA that if they have higher revenue, then it's up to the administrator to determine how that money will be used. So it's not necessarily going to come back to the utilities in a rebate. The administrator does have the authority to use the money for capital projects as well. We did get that from BPA when we talked to Marcus and one of the gentlemen that was involved in setting, well, proposing this new proposal. But going through the slide deck that he gave us, basically it looks like what they're trying to do is sort of front load the revenue, kind of like you're saying a good news, bad news, but it looks like from a budgeting standpoint for us, we've already are going to budget for the $40 million financial reserve surcharge. But if they do a secondary revenue based on BP20, we might be able to lower what we expect to pay out in surcharge and offset it with the secondary sales forecast. So it might not be a huge budget impact to our utility, Jim, just from a budgeting standpoint.
Okay. Well, that's good news.
But but without seeing a rate impact model of the proposal, it's there's so many different scenarios that we could run through. It's too tough to speculate really at this point until we get some more data or how they plan to roll it out.
Jim, we also talked to this is John. We also talked to Ryan to confirm his understanding. And what this looks like is a second mechanism that will probably be used to make up the deficit in financial reserves. That was identified as the most likely route for any money generated by having a higher base rate due to what would do in an environment where secondary sales are increasing. So basically, as you look at BP22, if BPA projects higher secondary sales than BP20, then that will result in using the BP20 estimate or the delta between the two, and we would see a higher base charge with less anticipated secondary sales than their 22 forecast. So it's a second mechanism that will probably go to the financial reserves, but it could go to something else. It could go towards reducing long-term debt or reducing future rate increases in the out years or subsequent rate cases. So that's how we understand the proposal as it is now, and we are going to have to be very cautious because there is a window, as Ryan describes it, in November and December, which we could get hit double, in which they have the secondary sales reduce at the same time they maximize the potential for a financial surcharge. So right. We'll have to keep an eye on it.
Yeah, the other thing that they're making the assumptions that revenues are going to increase from secondary sales. That, it's an assumption, and that hasn't been the case for quite a few years in terms of the actual revenue. And so that one concerns me too.
Yeah, and Jim, in a way, they do get rid of that potential because if they project higher secondary sales in 22, they cap it at what the 20 secondary sales actually are. So they get away from the forecast. So it puts a little less volatility, but like I said, we're going to have to watch them careful.
Okay. When are you guys still having routine meetings with Marcus? Because I wanted to attend those.
He Bonneville is not traveling for the foreseeable future, so any meetings that we have are initiated by us at this point.
Okay. We didn't have a quarterly call with him or anything. He's not scheduling that anymore.
He we can set something up, Jim, if you'd like to to talk to Marcus.
Yeah, well, there's a whole bunch of things, but we'll talk later about engaging with him.
Okay.
The last thing I have is I got a call from one of our customers, Ron Karpinowski, I believe, and he had an issue with us about locating a line and marking it, and then it got dug up and damaged and so forth and resulted in a potential bill to him. And he went through this 811 independent committee and got a reading on that, and they basically said that he didn't do anything wrong. And so this is just one of those accidents. So I guess the question for you is that enough for you guys to not send him a bill for those damages? In other words, the power line.
I haven't seen the results yet from the 811 report. I guess before we could comment, I'd like to see what they said. I've been in contact with him about every other month as he's been going through this process. And he did tell me that he had a meeting with 811, but I haven't heard from him since then. So if you have his contact information, Jim, I can give him a call and see if he can forward me the results of that.
I'll send you his phone number.
Okay.
Shouldn't that go through the appeal process and come back with a recommendation after looking at it?
I was in on that deal. This is Larry Morris. We had a meeting about 3 weeks ago with the Dig Law people. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yeah.
And, basically, what the outcome was that there was not enough evidence on either pro or con for the PUD or for Mr. Konopaski. They did give us a verbal, which I have been telling them for some time. I wanted something in writing. Marks were there. It was our word against their word, so they just didn't lean on it. So we will be getting something in writing from the Dig Law. As soon as I get that, I'll pass it on.
Okay, thank you. You have more, Jim?
That's all I have.
Okay. Well, on the 29th, there was a Energy Northwest virtual meeting of the executive board. There was some discussion about Elliot Manchester's departure by the end of this month, and seems to be the indication that they will appoint a interim administrator and then do a search for a permanent administrator. So more to come on that. I think everybody's heard that Elliot's going to Cal ISO down in California. So we've got a Californian heading the other way. That's a good thing. Anyway. All right. As for the meeting, the executive board meeting, the CEO gave his report. It was mainly just an update on some of the activities that they were doing, nothing of big importance there. Then this chief nuclear officer gave a report on the plant status. It's been online for 45 days. Net generation is way down to 420,000 megawatt hours. With a dispatch credit, this is credit for that they get for not running, for being curtailed, it would be 813,000 megawatt hours. That was the most economic dispatch they've ever experienced at Columbia. Report was given on COVID in the Tri-Cities area. They got 5,865 cases, 134 deaths, 60 hospitalizations. At Energy Northwest, they have 3 cases of essential personnel and 5 cases of non-essential personnel. The NRC issued a green citation, which is white is perfect, green is kind of a minor infraction, but it was based on failure to implement cybersecurity as per the program or the plan. Then there was a report given on Energy Northwest involvement of women in nuclear. And Energy Northwest is kind of leading the way in this. We've got a lot of women that are in the plant, but also in management there. So we got some accolades for that. Equipment performance is still red. That's something that requires some work. Then from the ESD, the Engineering Business Services, their metric is a margin and a business fund development, or business development fund, and they're looking pretty good there. There was a report given on one of their activities, which is EVITA, which is the Electrical Vehicle Initiative. They have 150 sessions through May and June. That means people charging their cars 150 times. That's at 9 stations. And that comes out to 1 or 2 sessions per day, which is, to me, is not very impressive, but that's what they're experiencing. They have Horn Rapids, which is the big solar farm that Energy Northwest is putting in with the IBEW. It's been delayed by the virus, and that impacts just about everything there. The battery, the BPA portion for interconnection, and so on. And the battery for that facility, which is 1 megawatt for an 8 megawatt nameplate output of the solar farm, that battery is made in China, which is kind of disturbing. Now they're kicking it out that the farm would be energized in September, and the battery perhaps in October, but that's all subject to change. The calibration labs at ESD are growing. They have an environmental lab, which is going for Department of Energy accreditation. And if they get that, that will open them up to bid on all of the work on Hanford, plus even nationally for work in environmental lab work. There's, I think I mentioned last time that there was a large wind farm going in the Benton service territory. That turns out to be a wind farm is going to be adjacent to Nine Canyons, which is an Energy Northwest wind farm. And the developer wants to lease property from Energy Northwest for that project. It's just in the developmental stages, though. Department of Energy, the Advanced Reactor Demonstration Program. I'll cover that. Well, I'll cover it now. This is part of the Resource Adequacy Task Force work. We're looking at two potential partnerings with Energy Northwest. One, of course, is TerraPower, and I think I've mentioned that before. That's Bill Gates' initiative. And the other one is X Energy. And, of course, we're continuing a relationship with NuScale, which is the SMR, which is Energy Northwest has agreement to operate in Idaho if and when they get enough participants to continue with the project. Actually, X Energy came out and toured Site 1, which is right next door to the Columbia Generating Station, and they were pretty excited. They've got everything they need there. They've got water. They got transportation. It's already licensed as a nuclear site, so that's favorable. Interesting that the Northwest Conservation Council power plan includes SMR, and they specifically talk about the NuScale SMR, but I think you can extrapolate this to any technology. And they say that is necessary, using their words, necessary to meet zero carbon. Nuclear will be needed. Then we met for the Resource Adequacy Task Force on the 22nd. Is that right? Yeah. No, I'm sorry. It's the following day. And well, let me jump back. I skipped over some stuff here. In the executive board meeting, talked with BPA contracts. The BPA is targeting the end of 25 to have those contracts signed. BPA has made a commitment to handle reliability and load for load following customers. What brought that up? Elliott had made a statement at PPC and a number of other locations and at Energy Northwest that resource adequacy wasn't Bonneville's problem. But by accepting that they're going to be reliable for, they're going to be responsible for reliability for our load following customers, and that'll give you some idea how important that is. Some utilities which are not load following, specifically like Clark, which is a very large PUD down in on the river there by Columbia River, they are they're looking at actually becoming a load following customer just because that this resource adequacy issue and that Bonneville is responsible for their reliability.
Will, could you say that again? I'm not sure I followed what you were saying there about what load following. In other words, you said resource adequacy. Meinzer said it's not really an issue for BPA.
That's what he said in the past. But this, which is a new policy by Bonneville, a new statement, would indicate that they will be responsible for resource adequacy since they will be underwriting reliability, but that's only for load following customers, not slicers or block purchasers.
And these are BPA customers?
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah.
Well, I mean, because some of this resource adequacy stuff is for the whole Northwest and not just BPA. That's what I'm trying to clarify. What customers?
No. Bonneville is only going to be responsible for their customers in their service area. They're certainly not going to be responsible for resource adequacy for Pacific Corp and PSE and all the other IOUs. That's not within their responsibility. By 2023, they're saying there will be a paper out from Bonneville for 2028 offerings. So that will be interesting that we and like I said before, they're looking to have contracts signed by the end of 2025. Back to Energy Northwest, the Nuclear Oversight Committee, was reported that there's two contracts for enriched uranium. One is with Urenco, the other one with Orano, and this would be 1.6 reloads each. Talking about a significant amount of money. With Germany scheduled to shut down their nuclear plants, with the Fukushima thing, with a lot of the Japanese plants are still down, so the demand for uranium is pretty low. So the proposal is to jump into this and to purchase enriched uranium for future fuel usage. This will require some bond financing, and we'll get the story on that, and I'll report it back. And they presently have enough fuel on hand for till 2027. Let's see what else we got here. There was a legislative update. The U.S. House of Select Committee on Climate Change put out their charter, and they recognized the need for nuclear to meet the carbon goals, which is, you always fear that there's still some opposition to nuclear energy out there, and it seems like that's kind of evaporating. And that's probably enough.
Hey, Will, I got a couple things. I skipped over something I'd like to follow up with.
Okay, sure.
I attended a Port Angeles Business Association meeting last week. Kilmer was the primary point of the discussion, and he went over a bunch of stuff, but there wasn't any real news there. He didn't really have any big ideas for us or how he was really going to do anything more than what we've already read about in the paper and so forth. So that wasn't too much for that. The business community is still concerned, of course, that, you know, they're going to have, we haven't seen the bow wave, the true bow wave of their problems until probably this winter with when people's unemployment kicks runs out and these federal assistance programs like CARES run out and so forth. And then, of course, heating bills go up, will impact our customers. The other thing is I sent to Waputa, George, a little paper I did on the EPA's TMDL report that I commented on at the last meeting because Northwest River Partners made a presentation and made some assertions that the breaching the Snake River dams really wouldn't have much impact on temperatures, and that's not exactly what the paper or the EPA's TMDL report says. And well, that data that's in that report is from USGS and the DART folks at Columbia Research Service and so forth, and that's vulnerable funded. So that's all government data, Corps of Engineer data too. Anyway, I sent that paper to George. He sent it to the Energy Committee, so I'm not sure which commissioners got it and so forth. Doug, did you send it to Will and Dave?
Yes, I sent it to Will and Dave. Right.
Okay, yeah, thanks. That's all I have.
Okay, since you added something, I'll add something. Our CEO at Energy Northwest, Brad Swarsky, is scheduled to leave. Retired just prior to the next refueling outage. So we're working with him to try to get him to stay through the refueling outage. We got a pretty deep management bench, but Brad's been kind of the driver for the excellence plan and plant performance. So we'll see how that pans out, and I'll update you later on what comes out of it. Okay, next item here is staff reports, and we got a bunch of them. Number one is the old PUD office in Port Angeles is sold. So you kind of gave away your presentation, Doug.
Yeah, took away the ending here, didn't I? We do have a number of presentations, including the KPIs that we got just into at last meeting. But I just wanted to give the good news that the old building was sold. We sold it for $650,000. And we get into our pockets, or we have in our pockets, $608,794.64. This has been going on for over 4 years. We're happy to get it sold. I believe it was a good deal with the owners that are the new owners, and we're happy we got it done. And so it was a good day. We no longer have the maintenance on it, no longer have the gardening and the landscaping on it, no longer have problems with homeless that might be next door or actually within our property area. So we're happy to get that done.
Well, that's good news. Congratulations.
Yeah, and Terry Lynn and their group, they did a great job keeping the building up, including the landscaping and inside, making sure any leaks that were there were taken care of. So it's been a long haul, but it's certainly nice to get it over with.
Okay, next item is safety disconnects. Sean?
Okay, give me just a second here. I'm going to share my screen.
Yeah, that's fine.
Did it come up for you guys?
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay, just real quick here. As you know, the governor has issued a series of proclamations that he keeps extending, stating that utilities in Washington can't perform disconnects for non-payment. However, Franklin PUD, working through Waputa, has floated the idea to the governor's office that we can be allowed to do what they're calling safety disconnects. And so this is just kind of a brief overview of what we plan to do starting next week. So the first question is, what is a safety disconnect? And basically, it's it's a disconnect to customers that we've had no contact with through mailings, phone calls, and actually going to their house and delivering a door hanger that says to contact us. If we don't have any contact through those means over the course of 30 days, we plan to perform a safety disconnect because we have no idea if there's still an account holder there, if the service is still active, or if there's even anybody there. So any customer needs to also have a contractual arrangement or an agreement to receive service from the district. And what happens sometimes is, you know, an example would be a roommate leaves a house and the service was in their name and they just stopped paying the bill, but there's other roommates in the house that are getting to enjoy the service but don't pay the bill. So we need to establish contact in these situations, and so that's what a safety disconnect is going to be.
Can I ask a question, Sean?
Yeah, go ahead.
You know, we had a case here, I don't know, may have been two years ago, where a man and his wife had a place around Port Angeles, and he went down to his summer home. He cut his phone off. He didn't have his mail forwarded. Didn't have anybody there to handle his house. So we shut him off, and all of his frozen. He had a number of freezers full of food and all kind of stuff. Do we have some kind of warning in our information for customers that they have to provide viable contact information to the PUD?
Yeah, it's part of our condition of service. Granted, some of these customers have been, you know, with us for 30 years and probably don't remember what they signed for, but it does say in our service packets that we do need updated information, mailing address, and phone numbers from customers.
Sean, I might add, on that particular customer, Will, we had his phone number. We had all the information. We called, whether his phone was changed or not, I can't recall, but we sent him letters. And what it was is he didn't even pick up his mail or have a way of getting his mail for, like, I think it was 6 weeks to two months. But we did work with him, and we
I recall he turned his phone off. He said,
right.
If I go to my summer home, I don't have mail forward. I turn my phone off. So, you know, sounds a little irresponsible, but that's
And to be honest, in 8 years that I've been here, that's the only example I can think of from a situation like that, Will. It was kind of a one-off.
As long as we warn people that, you know, you don't have to go into specifics, but they have to provide some line of communication, so.
Yeah, and in the first slide there, I did say 30 days, but in all actuality, a lot of these customers we haven't heard from since April.
Yeah.
So it's going to be well over 30 days. So after we perform a safety disconnect, if the original account holder contacts us and tells us that, hey, I'm still here, I'm just not paying because of the pandemic, we'll reconnect them immediately, generally within 2 hours. If someone other than the account holder contacts us, like a roommate or something, we'll have them sign for service in order to reconnect. And in that situation where it's a new customer coming in, there would be a connection fee that would apply to that scenario. But again, if they can't pay due to COVID, then it can be postponed. Once we do establish contact with a valid account holder, we are definitely having the CSRs convey these four important topics here. Number one, we're going to make it clear they do not have to pay at this time. However, they will have to enter into a payment plan with the district. The account charges are only postponed and not forgiven. They're going to have to pay all arrearages at some point. The customer will be made aware that the disconnect occurred because we had no contact and there was a safety concern, and we won't do any disconnects for non-payment. Some of the safety issues or concerns that we have is that we do have customers a lot of times that will just simply abandon their home without telling us. And so if we continue service to a vacant or unmonitored home, it does present a safety hazard. To provide or continue to provide service to someone who is not under contract and not our account holder is unsafe and presents safety and financial risk. We do have to have a way to get a hold of these customers in case of an emergency. So that's one of the main drivers right there. We believe that this safety disconnect program is allowed under state proclamation. Again, we've worked through WAPUTA, and also they've worked through the governor's office. Many customers have conveyed to us in error that they believe utility bills under the proclamation are free and they do not have to pay. And so anytime that we can establish contact with a customer, we can actually explain to them how the proclamation works and that they will have to pay at some point. Right now, we have 81 residential customers that would meet this criteria and 9 commercial customers that would meet the criteria. And we plan to begin moving forward with our safety disconnects at the beginning of next week. So that's just a quick overview. Does anybody have any questions on that?
So how do you – people paying with credit card or electronic fund transfer, how do we handle that? I mean, since they – again, that would be ideal for the utility, but the flip side of that is if you've got their credit card, you have to stop charging them at some point or what?
Everybody that's on auto pay continues to automatically draft at the due date every month. However, if they tell us to stop or if they want to come off of auto pay, they can do that right now.
Okay.
All right, Sean, is this this is going to cause, you know, probably a little bit of uproar with some people who believe that this is in violation of proclamation and so forth. If we put anything in the newspaper, we're going to do this, or even on the website, or through some other means that just serves as public notice.
We haven't done anything like that, Jim. We wanted to present it to all of you first to make sure that you're all okay with moving forward with the safety disconnect program.
That's my concern is that there are probably people out there that, like you said, that believe they don't have to pay the bill. They're ignoring the bills. They probably, when you guys call and it says the PUD, they don't answer the phone. So, we're going to catch some heat and, which is okay, but, you know, as long as we deal with it quickly. But on the other hand, it seems prudent that we should put out some sort of public notice on this.
Yeah, and I can work with Nicole on a public outreach strategy. But do remember, these are customers where we've gone to their house and delivered a door hanger, on their front door that says you need to call us within 3 days or 72 hours. And we haven't heard from them. And then we're making another trip back out there to perform the safety disconnect. So we've definitely done our due diligence to establish contact with the customer. And one of the things that we're going to do on our door hangers, I'll get into on the next topic here, which is the CARES. But we're also going to include grant information on the door hanger to encourage them to contact us as well.
Okay, sounds reasonable.
Okay, well, I'll jump into the next part if there's no more questions.
I think we can go ahead.
No questions.
Okay, so the next update here is on our CARES grants. We've been working with Mark Lane over at the county on a subrecipient agreement to receive some CARES funds that we can then pass on to our customers in the form of a grant. So tomorrow, we've already signed the subrecipient agreement on our end, but tomorrow the county commissioners, and I believe maybe even through Wednesday, are going to look to approve our agreement. And once they approve the agreement, we do plan to immediately advertise that we have grant money available, and we'll also begin accepting applications potentially as early as Wednesday of this week. It looks like we're probably going to get about $45,000 from the county. The CSRs, as well as through outreach on our website and other means, will communicate to all customers who we do establish contact with that CARES grants are available based on a matrix, which I'll show that here in a different slide. Customers, we recognize that we're closed right now, and so we have to be accommodating to how they can apply. So we're going to encourage customers to apply over the phone, through email, or even on our website. Nicole has created our application for the website, and it's ready to go live at this point. The information will also be displayed prominently on future door hangers, where I said safety disconnects here. So customers that we haven't been able to reach that are eligible for a safety disconnect, we will leave them a final door hanger that will outline the CARES program and ask them to contact us and provide us an application to see if they can get grant money. We will have to do monthly reporting to the county for all grants awarded to customers. And the big one here is that we have to spend all the money by October 31st of this year. That's the deadline from the county. And so here's a, here's what the matrix will be. It's on the application that Shanda has created. But basically, it's just a component of your household income based on your household size and where you fall within the federal poverty level. So, for example, if you had four people in your house and you made $35,000 per year, you'd be eligible for up to $225 one-time grant from the CARES Act. Our priority is going to be given to customers who are currently subject to disconnect and could have an adverse effect on health and safety. Basically, these customers, once the moratorium is lifted, they're going to be the most vulnerable to disconnect for non-payment. And right now, we have about 317 customers who are subject to disconnect under normal circumstances that are residential, and then 16 commercial. And this was as of August 6th. So that's just a quick update on where we're at with the CARES money, but hopefully by Wednesday of this week, we'll be able to start rolling out the applications and helping some of our customers that really need it. Any questions on the CARES?
That item, adverse effect of health and safety. Back in, am I still on?
Yeah, I'm trying to.
You're still on.
Okay. I know here some years ago it came up that people that had oxygen generators or some kind of health equipment that was powered by electricity that do we know who those people are so that we don't go out and cut somebody off that needs that that equipment?
Yeah, if customers identify and give us that information, we flag their accounts with a medical alert.
Okay, good.
But we also have to let them know that it's their responsibility to have a backup system or have somebody that help them out.
Yeah.
Because they could lose power. They could be at, you know, at the end of a long chain, and it could take us some time to get their system back up again. Power.
Yeah. Understood. Okay. Any more on that?
That's all I had.
Okay. Update on the Forks Operation Building, John Purvis.
Okay, yes, I'd like to give a couple presentations, the first being an update on the Forks Operations Building. And I'm going to try sharing the screen. And let me know if you now see the screen.
Yeah, we got it.
Okay, so there are some questions last meeting, and this is something we like to give periodically on such a major project of this scope. So the current update, I wanted to let you know that we're probably at least 1 week ahead of schedule. I have a vertical light blue line showing where we're at today. And the activities that are being worked on are the roofing or the sheathing, metal sheathing on the roof. We're also doing rough ends on HVAC and plumbing. So if you look at it in total, yeah, we're at least a week ahead. And this is really impressive because we started 3 weeks late due to the COVID. So we're at the point now with the roof going on that we're not going to be subject to damages should we experience an early storm season. So we're very pleased with that.
Yeah, John, let me add, too, on that chart you can see all the red. That means that's the critical path. That means almost everything they're doing is critical path. And so keeping on schedule is real important if we want to be done by the date. So looks like they're doing a great job and staying on schedule.
Yeah, Doug, thank you. And yeah, and, a lot of credit to Bill for meeting weekly with the architect and the contractor. This is one of the – this project has been almost problem-free from our perspective. Okay, so this is a webcam actually taken from Friday. You know, they have the decking for the roof on. They're doing the rough ends. And this week, I believe they're going to start applying the metal sheeting to the top of the building. So we take some time every day or two to take a look and see how things are going. And it's great that IT set us up with this camera. Okay, so there's been some questions about solar and why are we considering solar for the Forks Operations Building. And the short answer is there will not be solar initially, and it was looked at and considered in the design process, and I'm going to go over some of those considerations. While the average annual solar irradiation from in the Forks area is very similar to other parts of the county, we do have more challenging weather and environmental conditions that are more adverse. And based on our experience on electrical components installed in that area, the longevity of electric and electronic equipment, where you can experience up to 10 feet of rain a year, is somewhat short-lived compared to most of the rest of our service territory. We also were in a position where during our construction window, there were absolutely no availability of any state grants. Now, if this project had been done a couple years sooner, we would have looked hard at this location for community solar that went in Squim. And note, without the state grant, the financial viability is much more challenging. I think for Squim, that community solar project was credited by the state at 14 cents a kilowatt hour for the first 8 years, and that's what made it financially viable to the shareholders. For community solar, this wouldn't work for the Forks Operations Building. PUD would be funding all of the costs.
So, John, that's actual power generated at 14 cents, right?
Correct, that is.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, and the other problem with Forks area, it's a comparatively remote location, and our estimate conservatively is that construction, operations, and maintenance for photovoltaics is probably 10% higher than eastern Clallam County. Unfortunately, there is no county contractor that specializes in this type of solar. It's usually coming from Jefferson or Kitsap further away. And the further west you move, especially for construction, we're going to incur additional costs by locating solar in the Forks area. Also, the physics of the roof is not as conducive as it could be based on the orientation of the building as well as the relatively low-sloped roof. And every one of our analysis on solar, community solar, any solar project, consistently demonstrates that a ground-mounted equipment can be done at the lower cost if the cost of the land is low or if the land is available without any additional costs, such as one of our facilities, a Windy Way property or a substation-type property. Or even at the Forks Operations Center, if we were going to put solar out there, it would probably be ground-mounted, and that would be the lowest cost to do so. Okay, so from our perspective, there's better options if and when Clallam PUD constructs PUD-owned and operated solar generation. And currently, and I expect in the near future, grant opportunities require demand mitigation, effectively meaning some form of battery backup for Clallam. That complicates economics. The current community solar grant funding that's available requires that we generate during our peak demand, and to do that, we would have to size a battery to do it, making it more costly. While we can do a community solar or a solar project for under $2 a megawatt hour, even with maybe even with battery backup, it's awful hard to compete with the very large-scale projects that, let's say, a Snohomish does on community solar. I hate to say it, it makes our projects look less financially viable due to our location and the size of our utility. We may have to look further afield to get the lowest cost utility scale solar at some point, and over to Eastern Washington or maybe even outside the state, and we'll probably have to do so in conjunction with batteries for shifting the load from when it's available and when it's used. And as a reminder, unfortunately, the Pacific Northwest, our area, is actually one of the poorest areas for the annual solar radiation per NREL. But when you look in Eastern Washington, it does get considerably better, 50-60% more generation for the same equipment. But if you look down towards California, Nevada, and Arizona, those areas are probably twice as effective. And more importantly, they're almost 99% available as far as meeting their capability of generation. Very little cloud cover, and the ability to rely on those solar sources as a, I'm not going to call it a base load, but when the sun's shining, it's essentially a base load with a very small battery backup for intermittent clouds that may occur. So when we look in the long range forecast, that is where the best solar opportunities are for the Western Interconnect. So I guess that's it for the Forks operations, as well as the questions from last week related to the utilization of solar on the Forks operations building. If we did do solar at Forks operations or anywhere else, it would most likely be a lower-cost ground-mounted equipment, somewhat similar to what we did in Squim.
Yeah, John, you mentioned large-scale solar projects. Some time back, actually, Energy Northwest has 300 acres, additional unused acres, leased on the Hanford Reservation. And some years back, a French company was interested in installing a big solar farm there. They backed out, but that's still available, and it's being worked to find somebody that would be interested. So,
John, this is Jim. This is a pretty quick presentation on solar, and it begs, I think, more questions than I probably can, unleash at this particular moment. But I guess what I'd like to see is a little bit more comprehensive presentation on what you're seeing in terms of solar in today's prices. And like you said, you gave an example of $2 a megawatt hour, and I didn't follow the logic, but then you said that wasn't going to work. But I think we should do a better in-depth look at this, and also say, well, okay, if these are the prices we have today that we can get in Clallam County with generation we have and so forth, particularly in the Squim area, then what about a year from now or 2 years from now? And notwithstanding what grants are maybe around or not, we still should I think really lean forward in terms of solar with and/or with battery backup, and as a means of building resiliency in the community, so it's not just a simple price equation, but it helps us with resiliency, and also it's possible to knock off peak demand in the hour because we are using batteries. There's
peak demand in the morning, I meant, because we are using batteries or something. So I think I'd like to request that, you know, maybe not at the next meeting, give you guys some time to really think about this, but do a more in-depth presentation on where we can go with solar.
Yeah, Jim, as a matter of fact, based on comments and commentary over the last several board meetings, here in the next month and most 2 months, we do plan to give a more comprehensive overview of what staff is looking at. And this would be include community solar with battery backup as a project associated with CETA 1200, which is an obligation at some point in time for the utility. We're also looking at utility scale large megawatt capacity batteries that we started looking at last year and due to CETA in a way that might actually be cost viable within the next 3 years. Unfortunately, there is a very large price tag on the order of close to $10 million, but it could be cost viable in the very near future. We're also looking at the small modular nuclear reactor, if that will ever become cost viable for a share, and at some point, if we're obligated to become zero carbon, what that would look like. So we are looking at numerous technologies and trends, and have been for the last year and a half in the CETA environment, looking forward to what we're obligated to do to become carbon neutral by 2030, carbon free by 2045, as well as the low income assistance criteria, section 1200 in that legislation. So our plan is to give a more substantial presentation at some point within the next 4 to 6 weeks.
Yeah, thanks, John. That's good to point out. What this was mainly to do was to answer the questions that we had, some of the customer questions regarding solar out in Fork. So it was kind of a quick answer here. Okay.
Yeah, I appreciate that. That's why I didn't want to just kind of unload a whole bunch of questions.
Okay, well, appreciate that, Jim. We'll do that. Will, I had forgotten. I forgot to include Steve. We have an update on the broadband grant status that I'd like Steve to give an update on before we get into the KPIs. Is that okay?
Yeah, that's fine. Just one statement on that last conversation. You know, I'm not sure we're equipped to evaluate new technologies because it goes way beyond batteries and solar. You look at the SMR approach, if that goes forward, they're going to be looking for utilities to as participants in that. Grant is showing a lot of interest in an SMR. So I don't know if we have the staff time or whatever to really evaluate all of that. Maybe that's a question. Do we have the staff time, or do we need to maybe, if we go forward with doing that, perhaps we need to get a consultant in to have a look at it.
Hey, Will, this is John. Basically, the review that we're doing is a fairly high-level review based on publicly available information, and it's similar to the type of analysis we do for all engineering projects, and actually all of our projects now. And it's not as sophisticated as what you would need before you make some kind of decision. So I would call this more of a preliminary type of analysis that does not take an extensive amount of time. But at some point, if we were going to invest large monies into any of these investments, yes, we would have to rely on outside consultants and the ability of getting that fine granularity is probably beyond the capability of staff and certainly beyond the time constraints of staff.
Yeah, in my world, we used to call those scoping estimates. So you're talking about just a scoping estimate.
That is absolutely correct. A couple, 3 days spent on a project, brainstorming and looking at the latest economics.
Of course, scoping estimates, because they're predicting the future, are usually always wrong. But anyway, okay, good.
Yeah, they do
okay. Anything else on that? Okay, our next item is update on 2020 quarter key performance. Do you want to do Steve's?
Excuse me, Will. I got the second presentation. Update for net meter solar and Department of Commerce reporting. There was a very good question during the last meeting as to why there's no reporting of distributed generation solar. And I wanted to give an overview basically to clarify why that is the case. And this is just, I believe, four slides to explain RPUD and our fuel mix.
Okay. Sorry, John. Just an oversight.
Okay. So basically, okay. Sorry about that. There's something missing here in my presentation, probably due to the connection. But when BPA provides us and the Department of Commerce with our fuel mix, they provide hydropower, nuclear, a small slither of natural gas, and then that portion that I have coming out of the pie chart is what they call, Sean, help me out.
Those are unspecified.
Unspecified, yes. Yeah, unspecified. Okay. I apologize for the defect in my presentation. But those are unspecified, and they're about 3%. And they're BPA market purchases that include hydro, nuclear, as well as carbon sources, solar and wind. So they are reported without the renewable energy portion or credit. So they're considered basically carbon no matter what the source. Excess BPA sales of hydro or wind farm generation sold on the market typically do not come to us with the renewable energy portion credit, the REC, so it's like it's a carbon source. So what happened is when we get this, we try to estimate the carbon content and the local distributed generation for solar. So BPA provides their Tier 1 allocation, which includes hydro and the Energy Northwest nuclear under long-term exclusive contract. We also have a share in the Packwood Hydro system in Lewis County, I believe. BPA actually manages that for us, and BPA also includes their unspecified market purchases to meet demand. Okay, from this information, PUD staff does a breakdown of the unspecified purchases based on something called the Northwest Power Pool, as well as what we believe the calculated or estimated installed net metered wind and solar. And this information is actually was presented during the PUD and Clallam County joint meeting. Commissioner meeting back in October of last year, part of a presentation reducing the district's carbon footprint, and this presentation is included on our website. So basically, what we had at that time when we looked at the 2018 resource mix, we broke down the unspecified and added back in the net generation here locally. And this is what we believe is the true breakdown of our supply. Once again, primarily hydro, a substantial portion of nuclear. But there you see it. I have it highlighted. About 0.32 for the 2018 fuel mix reporting. That's our estimate for the average annual production of rooftop solar. It's a pretty small portion of our total fuel mix, but it's a fairly large portion of our non-BPA contribution, or a large portion relative to the undesignated sources that BPA provides. So, as of 2020, there are 362 net meter solar facilities in Clallam County. The combined capacity is about 2.5 megawatts, pretty big number. We're currently supplying about 0.34% of our annual load through these distributed generations, including our community solar that we install in Squim. And this is an eye-opener. Solar supplies 20% of our non-BPA supply. Almost all the rest is provided by our shares in the Packwood hydro system. The breakdown is roughly 20-80 or 20-79 with a small amount of wind distributed generation. Now, in the summertime, we can see as much as 3.4% of the load on a sunny summer afternoon being supplied by the solar distributed generation. On some feeders, that could be as high as 6 or 7%. So during those times, it is a fairly large portion of our fuel mix. Of course, at nighttime or in the wintertime, it drops down substantially. As of 2020, we looked at the interconnects, and we believe we're adding about 30 per year, totaling 250 kW. And this is even with the expiration of the state incentives for customer rooftop solar. So we're still keeping along on a similar pace of what we saw before the expiration.
John, this is probably understood. That 2.5 megawatt capacity, that's nameplate, right?
That's correct. And my next slide will kind of demonstrate it. If you take at this time, if you look outside, we got sunny conditions. We're probably approaching 2 megawatts. Now, a lot of facilities face south, some east, some west, but I would not doubt that we're probably producing at this moment close to 1.8, 1.9 megawatts as of today, this hour, which is probably over 3% of our total system load at this time.
So is any of that battery backed up?
We have three interconnects that have battery backup.
Thank you.
Okay, so this gives you an idea, and this is somewhat based on the community solar and Squim. We have a really good idea of what production is with respect to capacity. And as you see in April, May, June, July, and even August, we have high production with respect to nameplate capacity. Even for a fixed angle and fixed facing production, if we had something that rotated and followed the sun in the summertime, we could probably generate close to 60% of the potential output of the sun. But you know, on a fixed system, low cost fixed system, you're kind of tied to the seasonal variations. The dashed line is basically a relative system load per month, which is a little bit, different or opposite to what our solar production is. But it does explain why in the summertime, during the day, our output for solar is significant. And when you get into the winter months and after hours, it's pretty small. So that is an overview of why the Department of Commerce reporting does not show any reported solar. It's because from BPA's perspective or power supplier's perspective, that is net metered, and it's seen as an offset for load as opposed to a supply from outside the county.
It would be interesting to see our own little duck curve for those systems as well.
Hey, John, on your last chart, I assume that when you say average and the scale on the left was in percent and it went up to a max of 16% in, I guess, June. That assumes a 24-hour day, 30 days a month or something. But I mean,
correct. Yeah, correct, Jim. So basically when we're looking at a solar output of 16% of the nameplate, that presumes 24/7. So, of course, we don't have daylight 24/7. So it does come down, and we get our maximum when the angle of the incline pretty much matches the sun's position normally. So, yes, that is correct. And that explains that why our average solar for the year is 0.34%, while the capacity is probably 10 times that. So, yeah, that is exactly why. In the summertime, if you looked at just the daylight hours, that's going to go up into the 30s or higher. And you look at clouds. Sometimes we have clouds like this morning, but we can estimate. As a matter of fact, any customer who installs a fixed-mounted constant incline solar has a pretty good idea that they're going to capture about 12 or 13% of the solar radiation for this area over the course of the year, with much higher production in the summertime and daytimes.
Okay, John, is that all you had?
That's it.
Okay, well, before we get into the KPIs, let's take, I would say 5 minutes, but you guys always take 10, so let's do a 7.5 minute break.
Okay, Will, we can get Steve in before then, too, on the broadband grant update.
You want to do that before we break? Or?
Yeah, well, sure, we could. I think Steve's ready.
Okay, all right. Steve, go for it.
Yeah, it's only going to take me about 3 or 4 minutes to tell you guys where we're at. So where we're at, the PUD is applying for grant funding for a low-interest loan or a low-interest loan with Washington State Public Wards Broadband Grant and Loan Program, which is allocating approximately $9.1 million in low-interest loans and another $8.6 million in grants. We are hoping for a grant. The goal of the program is to increase broadband connectivity to the West End. The Public Works Board is accepting applications through September 9th of this year. And the name of the project that we've decided to apply for is called Broadband Backbone Construction Project. And the project's goal is to build out the backbone that will facilitate ISPs being able to expand broadband capability in Forks and LaPush. We're applying for a $4.1 million grant, and the list of potential applicants for all these grants includes not just PUDs, but cities, towns, counties, tribes, ports, other special purpose districts, quasi-municipal corporations, nonprofits, corporate associations, LLCs, and other incorporated businesses or partnerships. So there's quite a bit of competition for this $9.1 million in loans and then the other $8.6 in grants. But we're right in the middle of making our application. We're going to make the September 9th deadline, and we'll kind of keep you posted on how that process goes along. So that's kind of where we're at on
So, Steve, how much what's the appropriation for these grants? How much money is in the pot?
Well, it looks like there's 9.1 in loans, and there's another 8.6 in grants that are available.
And how much are we asking for?
4.1.
Wow. Okay.
Which obviously won't get us all the way to Forks, but it will definitely extend our backbone a considerable distance so that, you know, we are making a concerted effort to get into that direction. So,
okay. Well, thank you.
Yep.
Anything else before we break? Okay, let's take a 7.5 minute break.
Hi, Dave.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. How about for you?
Good. Yeah, just summer's going fast here.
Have we got summer yet?
Well, yeah, I think at least the last 3 weeks, although who knows how long it'll last. You know, every year you get it at a different time, so.
Yeah. Well, it's nice while it's here.
Yeah.
Okay, everybody back, ready to go? Yep.
Yeah, I'm back.
Everybody back? Hello?
Yeah, I said I'm back. It's Jim.
Okay, Jim, you're right on the ball. Dave, you're there?
I'm here.
Okay, we'll go ahead and reconvene then. All right, so our next item is the update for the 2020 second quarter KPIs, the General Manager and Director reports. Who's queued up?
Yeah, we left off. Tom's up next.
Okay.
Good. Commissioners, I am going to share my screen here. So you can see my PowerPoint presentation on the KPIs for water.
The real backyard? Now, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, that's that's my view from my desk behind me. Okay. There you go. So for water and wastewater systems, our KPIs, we have three of them, and they are ensure reliable supply, practice environmental responsibility, and manage resource portfolio. So for ensuring reliable supply, well, John Purvis went through this for electric last week. So we pretty much have the same definition and picture of excellence. But I'd like to emphasize that for water, one of the pictures of excellence items is the unscheduled outages due to aging infrastructure are kept to a minimum, and infrastructure is replaced on a routine basis and looped for redundancy whenever possible or necessary. So I will be talking about that in a moment. So for our first KPI for reliability, we're looking at major emergency events per quarter. So I have the report for the first quarter and the second quarter. And, you know, we set a pretty high standard here in the water department, only three emergency events indicates a red condition, 2 to 3 is yellow, and 0 to 1 is almost near perfect per quarter. So in the first quarter, we had a main break out in Clallam Bay on Highway 112. And that's an emergency condition because we only have one guy out there. We have to send crews all the way from Carlsberg to assist. You know, we can get a pretty quick response from our Marquess out there in CQ to isolate the break, but you know, we have to tow our or get our dump truck and tow our excavator out there as well. So and the type of breaks that we get out there are typically on AC pipe, which is asbestos cement, and there's a lot of AC pipe running through Clallam Bay and CQ, and so that's been problematic for quite a while. This other one.
Tom, the obvious question is, do we have a program to replace that or slip line it or do something about that? Or
yeah, I do have a recovery plan. And
you're going to talk about it, so okay.
Yeah, in just a moment.
All but right,
yeah, and we got a Public Works Board loan for that. And then the second event was that there was a service line under highway, close to Highway 101 in Gale's Addition area near one of the businesses over there. And again, that was aging infrastructure of that service. Gale's Addition has some pretty old services out there. In the second quarter, we had a main break on North Bagley Creek Road. It was part of that construction that's going on out there right now on Highway 101 as part of the, you know, the culvert replacement projects by WASHDOT. And they actually had a directional driller going across the highway, and we had a locate in there for a water main that wasn't indicated properly. And, you know, we just got lucky and drilled right through our pipe. So that brings up the point, well, why wasn't the pipe located properly? Well, you know, we're living with a legacy from when that pipe was actually put in a long time ago in the 70s, back when Phil Jackson was the general manager, and when they were constructing the Fairview Water System, or LED1, the decision back then was not to put in locate wires along with AC pipe. And it's a long story, but we're living with that legacy about why that happened. So we do have a policy now that whenever we have new main put in, that the locate wires are all put in with them. So on the second quarter, well, that was the second quarter. There was also in the second quarter on May 31st a major leak of chlorine from liquid chlorine from one of our totes, 300-gallon storage vessels. And it was designed for secondary containment under that tote. So all the chlorine leaked out of the connection to the tote because one of our operators put in replaced the connection with an aluminum part. Now chlorine turns out that is kind of corrodes aluminum. And within 3 days after installing that part, had completely corroded. It looked like an oyster with barnacles all over it, oyster shell, and drained the whole tank, and it was over a weekend. And what happened is that some of that leaked over into the adjacent secondary containment, which had alum in it, and when the two combined, the chemical reaction let off a vapor, some chemical gas, which got through the entire plant. And we had to go back and replace a lot of the aluminum electrical components throughout the plant. Luckily, it wasn't a whole lot. Most of our wiring had some silver coating on it, so that was preserved and not affected. But you know, we had to go through a lot of work with hazmat companies to come in and collect the leaked chlorine and then dispose of it properly. So that was quite an exercise we went through. Never really had encountered this problem before. So the response recovery plan there is do not use aluminum of any sorts in the water treatment plant. use you know, other PVC connections or things like that.
So Tom, does this kind of require some training of your folks? I mean, you know, when you're handling different materials, whether they're compatible with the metal components is pretty damn important. So.
Yeah. You know, the last time I recall ever having to deal with one of those connections to the totes, the chlorine totes, was back when the plant was built in the first place, and it was up to staff to design that, and you know, we came up with materials that were non-corrosive to chlorine, yeah. And that was apparently forgotten by the operator at this time, and so we'll make sure that this story lives on and gets passed to the next guy, and make sure that we're not using any materials that are going to be corroded by the chemicals we use at the plant. And then the last item there, again, this was a main break. It's called Harbor Crest. It's in the Gales Edition water system. And again, this was a aging infrastructure item. So, you know, that's popped up several times here as the cause of the major emergency event. So what we've been doing for a recovery plan is to work with WAPUTA Water Committee to lobby for more funds to replace aging infrastructure in the water industry. And we've had some luck with that. You know, the funding agencies come to our quarterly meetings fairly often. And the Public Works Board was there, along with Department of Health, Office of Drinking Water. And we're always telling them that, look, we're way past the design life on many of our water systems throughout the state for our pipes and infrastructures. And, you know, we need funding in order to keep up with the replacement. So last year, beginning of the new biennium of the state, Public Works Board came up with some funding, some low-interest loans for aging infrastructure. So they came through. They listened to us. That was great. So we applied, and we got a little bit over $600,000 in pre-construction loan money to start the engineering and design for replacement of all the at-risk water mains out there in Clallam Bay and CQ. And also looking at possibly resiting a reservoir out there. And so we got that, and we started working on that. And hopefully the next biennium, next year, there will be construction money available for that we can follow up with. So that's our recovery plan for our aging infrastructure, is to continue to work with WAPUTA and industry groups to try to get more funding available for replacement of these pipes that, you know, were put in the 60s and they're way past their design life.
That first item on second quarter, contractor drill through the main, was that contractor working for the PUD?
Yeah, he was. He was working for the electrical department. They were putting conduit under the highway to reroute their electrical lines for that Bagley Creek project from West Side. So it was just one of our own.
Yeah, okay. I was going to say that that was beyond your control, but I guess not. Okay.
So on to the next API category. This is environmental responsibility, and this is meeting regulatory requirements. Recognizes our actions have short and long-term impacts on environment and on regulatory customer costs. And the district meets, the picture of excellence is that the district meets all environmental regulations at the lowest cost. And that's an important thing that I might point out in a moment. And the district seeks to identify and implement cost-effective actions and that enhance environmental responsibility. So in 2020, well, we didn't have any violations. And, you know, we do water quality monitoring on a regular basis per the Department of Health. They have monitoring requirements and schedules set up for various different kinds of constituents. But the one that is monitored the most is chlorine residual in the distribution system for where we have the source of the water system is a surface water source, and they're more susceptible to contamination, and it's really important for surface water systems to maintain a residual. And during one of the sanitary surveys where the Department of Health comes out and reviews our operations in various water systems, they put on a more strict requirement that we had to have 7 days a week monitoring of our distribution in chlorine levels. And we had only been doing them 5 times a week. So that didn't turn out to be a violation this year because we worked with Department of Health and installed a real-time chlorine monitoring device in the distribution system. It just was convenient when we were building the Deer Park Road booster pump stations to put a chlorine analyzer in one of them. And Department of Health accepted that as a point where we could take those measurements. And now we don't have to send a guy out there on overtime on the weekends to do sampling. So we're reducing our costs there. And another thing that we've done to reduce cost is, again, having to do with chlorine. In the surface water treatment plant, there's a contaminant called disinfection byproducts, and that's byproducts of chlorination. And they get worse the longer water stays in the distribution system. So on those areas, let's say in Fairview, down at a dead end of one of our pipe runs, that the disinfection byproduct risk can be pretty high. And so what we do is we flush water through those pipes to freshen them up every, you know, periodically, monthly. And we had a flushing plan. But we found out that it would be more cost effective if we didn't just go to the little branches off of the main pipe, for instance, on O'Brien Road, if we kept the water flowing more in O'Brien Road. So what we did was put a little bypass valve down at the bottom of O'Brien right by the highway and allow a small amount of water to flow through this bypass continually. And that kept the water fresh in that whole run of O'Brien Road, and resolved a lot of our issues that we had with all the side streets. So, you know, the side streets were getting aged water before, and now they're getting fresh water. So those, and it didn't cost a whole lot to put in a little bypass in one of our pressure-reducing valve vaults. And so it was a pretty simple, low-cost solution that had a great impact. And the third KPI is managing our resource portfolios, and that definition is optimizing between supply and demand requirements of both long and short and long term, allows us to improve efficiency, meet regulatory requirements, and meet customer needs and expectations. The picture of excellence is continually optimized portfolio, meeting all resource at the lowest cost. And so we have a few KPIs, two of them for this objective. And the first one has to be to do with our distribution system leakage. That's the leakage out of our distribution lines. And so we have to account for all the water that we pump into those systems from our source, plus the production volume. And then we have to see, you know, how much we actually sell to our customers and see what the ratio of the difference is. And we also have to account for, you know, main breaks when the fire department goes out there, fights fires. We try to keep track of as much water as possible. And so every this percentage, distribution system leakage percentage, is a rolling average. And so every year we update it. 10% is the target for our larger systems, and 15% loss is the target for our smaller systems. Turns out Cloud Bay CQ has really jumped up recently, and it's telling me that we're getting the Public Works Board loan to address this problem. We're right on the edge there, but still in the green. It's 10% or less below the target is green for PA Composite, Carlsberg and Evergreen, and Panoramic Heights. Island View is that little 32 customer system up west of CQ, and that actually has a 15% target because it's all so small. And so I both put that in the yellow. Nevertheless, you know, we're below the target, 11.7. We're actually still in the green, but for a small system. So we're doing pretty good there. We're addressing the problem in Cleveland Bay CQ right now. That's our recovery plan. And then the other KPI for managing our resource portfolio has to do with our water rights and how much water rights do we have now versus what's the full build out? How many water rights do we need for full build out of the water systems? That is something that we started doing with Carlsberg as part of the planning for the sewer. And So I've done this for all of our water systems, and we'll say, well, where are we? Well, we know that Carlsberg, we're going to need more water rights to meet the full build-out demand. That was the conclusion from the sewer facilities plan back in 2013. And so we're at 47% of full build-out, but, you know, we do have a very significant recovery plan. We're working with the county on getting new water rights. And, you know, we've drilled that new well out on Old Olympic Highway at the end of Carlsberg Road, which should go a long ways towards meeting the build-out percentage. It still won't get us all the way there, but we have time, obviously, to full build-out. And how much time that is, it's hard to tell. The way things have gone in the last 20, 30 years, it just seems to be episodic. There seems to be high growth periods and then low, and high and low. It's not a real even thing. So, but we're keeping an eye on it. So when we get close to our full-out demand, that we're staying ahead of the game and getting water rights early on, because it's getting more difficult to get water rights as time goes on, and it's getting way more expensive as well. As we have seen with Carlsberg and going through the the Dungeness water management rule, pay for a lot of mitigation. So we looked at all the different water systems, climate-based CQ. You know, this is an 80% cutoff, you know, which is kind of arbitrary, but, you know, we're keeping our standards kind of high here. The climate-based CQ is at 79. We're not real concerned about that. I don't have a recovery plan because growth is not very zero out there right now.
Yeah, Tom, can I ask a question about Carlsberg?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, part of the sewer agreement with the county was that they would assist in getting us water rights.
Right.
Is that working or not?
It's working at their pace.
okay.
All right. The well has been drilled and almost completely tested. There's one more test that really has to be done. The final report from the hydrogeology regarding that well and its performance has been completed, and it's ready to submit to ecology. However, you know, there's this one thing in the report that says, well, we're going to update this report once we get the final testing results in. Yeah. So this is a key report. In order to get a water right from ecology, you have to have this report. And it has to be complete. So step by step, we're making it there. But it's really encouraging that the risk that was taken to drill so deep actually came up with a fair amount of water. And, you know, there could be, they're saying 250 to 400 out of that well right now. And if you drill a larger well in the future, you could get over 500 gallons per minute. So that's a lot of water, and it was good quality, so there's no requirement for treatment. And so we took a risk, and it worked out. There was a lot of reward to this. So I hope that answers your question.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, well. Evergreen, we're at 69%. That's probably the other next water system that we really seriously have to look out for getting new water rights because it's in such a higher growth area. Island View, we got a lot of water rights out there. They're in the green. Fairview, we applied for a new water right for full build out back in 2013. So, of course, that's not going anywhere until we find a mitigation plan for that. And that's just going to sit in ecology's files until we really see a need to get going on this if growth really spikes up. But we do have the water rate filed. As far as Gales, Monroe, and Mount Angeles, we have the water source is wholesale water supply from the city of Port Angeles. And, you know, we have to make sure that there is enough water specified in the wholesale water agreement with the city so that we maintain the amount that's needed as build-out occurs. We have an existing wholesale water agreement with the city right now that was from 2006, and it was specified that they could have 999 gallons per minute supplied to us. The physical feasibility of that has never really been examined. Let's say it seemed somewhat like an arbitrary number. So I just talked with the public works director there of City of Port Angeles this morning, and he's committing to meeting whatever demand we have in the future, but we want to make sure that we're setting a realistic supply rate in the agreement that meets our demand, current and future, up to like 20 years demand forecasts. Panoramic Heights is looking good. That's just a small water system, 17 customers, so we're looking good there. So that's the end of my presentation, my KPIs here for water.
Okay. Well, thanks. Tom, thanks.
We've got Jamie up next. We're going to try to.
I've got a question for Tom.
Okay, go ahead.
Water pressure. Why don't we have a KPI for water pressure? That obviously is an important factor. It's not just the fact that it's either you got water or you don't have water because of an outage, but can you talk a little bit about why we wouldn't want to measure water pressure and kind of have a metric for it?
Well, there are certain requirements that we have to meet for water pressure that, all water systems have to be designed to maintain. And that is, when you have really high demands, like a peak hourly demand, you're supposed to be able to provide 30 pounds per square inch at every water service. And during fires at the hydrants and all the other connections around there, you need to provide at least 20 PSI. So, we have designs in the water system to begin with to make sure that we have enough storage at a high enough elevation above the water system in order to provide that kind of pressure. And also we have to have enough source capacity to pump enough water to meet the peak hourly demands, or else the pressure is going to go down. We have the pumping capacity and we do have the storage capacity, and that was something that gets evaluated every 6 years in our water system plan update. So in the last update, we met those criteria. Some pipes need to be replaced with larger ones, and we're kind of making our way through there. So that could be a KPI. Are we replacing pipes in order to make sure we're maintaining pressure? But, a lot of that has to do with aging infrastructure. We're going to be replacing those pipes anyhow.
So you feel like that the design aspect of this thing takes care of that, but you also said that we have to replace pipes. I assume we have water pressure issues in some neighborhoods, because I guess I've seen some indications that we're getting some complaints.
Yeah, and particularly there's one place up in Mount Angeles where the amount of pumping capacity that we had was enough to meet their peak hour demand, so we didn't have to have a lot of storage to equalize those peak hours. And but it turned out that, a long time ago when it was designed, even though we had a lot of pumping capacity, the actual reservoir was not high enough to provide all the pressure that the new standards require. Back then, they probably didn't have those standards that I explained to you, 20 and 30 PSI under different conditions.
All right. Okay.
So we do have a recovery plan for that to raise the reservoir.
Thanks.
Okay. Thanks, Tom. Will, we've got Jamie up next. We've got about five more to go here, so I don't know if you want to cut it off and continue next time eventually. You can play that by ear and see what you want to do. But Jamie will be the next one up.
Hi, commissioners. I'm going to see if I can smoothly share my screen here for you guys.
Let me answer, Doug. I got logged out there for a minute. How about we cut it off at 4 o'clock like we did before?
Okay, because we've got public comment too, so 4 o'clock would be fine.
Okay. All right.
Sorry, hi, commissioners. Hi. No, that's okay. I'll make this quick. So for human resources, we have attract and retain great people. in our strategic plan. And the definition of that is providing competitive compensation, benefits, development, and promotion opportunities in a healthy and secure work environment. The district recognizes people are critical to our success and helps maintain a proficient and stable workforce. So as we've met and discussed this, the picture of excellence we've defined is that the district is known as an excellent employer with outstanding employees. The district attracts and retains great employees that are highly skilled and provide exceptional service with a smile. Our employees are proud of where they work. So how we measure that, we identified some key areas, and one of them would be performance appraisals. And the district has worked really hard over the last year to improve the time frame that these performance appraisals are conducted. And so we actually narrowed down, you can see here that just 15 days past due, which in the big scope of things is not that late. But we are unfortunately in the red this quarter because of COVID, with some of the employees out of the office. And when we took that pause and had people go home for their safety, it did cause for some of the performance appraisals to be done, more than 15 days from their due date. So we were unable to meet our green goal of 100% turned in on or before the due date. But, honestly, with, some are just 16 or 17 days past due, so that's still a very reasonable time frame and a good improvement for the district. The next KPI would be our turnover rate. So in the past, we've reported this number as a combined number, and there was a request last time it was reported to break it out between retirement and then involuntary and voluntary termination. So that's why we see a green and a yellow score circled here. So when we look at retirement, our turnover rate was 3%. So that put us in the green with a turnover rate less than 5% in the last 12 months. We all, kind of watch succession planning and know that we have retirements and upcoming retirements, and that's what usually drives these numbers here at the district. And then in the last 12 months, we did see for probably one of the first times in a long time, an increase in voluntary terminations. There were a couple involuntary terminations in there, and that put us around a 7% mark. We had a lot of employees that were looking at some work-life balance, other opportunities out of the area as well as in Clallam County. And so we did have a certain amount of employees that went on to other ventures here at the district. And then another KPI is training attendance. So Human Resources works hard every year to provide in-house training opportunities. We've participated in the NWPPA leadership program and have brought those in so that all of our managers and supervisors can attend those and all be receiving the same message. So this is looking at the last quarter, which due to COVID, we have not been able to host any in-house training opportunities this year. So we do not have one of these markers circled. I will say for 2019, though, we were in the yellow. We had 91% attendance at our in-house opportunities that we hosted. And then lastly would be the RP3 score. And a few of the other direct reports have talked about this last week. But one of the areas in the APPA award is workforce development. And so they go through and evaluate policies and procedures, training and development, and then succession planning. And they look at the big picture on how the district monitors that, what kind of opportunities they provide for their employees, and they go through it very thoroughly. So it was great for us to see 100% on that score this year, or when we received it. And that is it for the attract and retain great people.
Jamie, could I ask a question? I'm going to give away my old corporate background here.
Yes.
A lot of this is, well, we say we're attracting and retaining great people, but are they doing the right things? Do we need a metric to say, well, meeting expectations, needs improvement, or, you know, would that be a better indicator or one an additional indicator?
Do you have a specific area for that, Will?
Well, job performance.
Job performance. So we do have for our staff employees, for our non-represented.
Oh, yeah, I know. You can't. Yeah.
The pretty thorough performance appraisal that does hit on all of those areas, you know, definitely needs improvement if they're a strong performer. You know, we aim to have all of our staff employees be in the outstanding category, and I would say 99% of them, you know, do fall into that.
So it also is performance aligned with the strategic plan? So
yes, it is. Yeah, Doug has actually challenged all of us direct reports, and that trickles down to our supervisors to incorporate the different projects that we have that in our matrix that are tied to the strategic plan in those performance appraisals. So you will see a great example would be in human resources, you know, for attendance, for hosting in-house training opportunities. So I can delegate, you know, the HR coordinator to then work on scheduling those, and I tie that directly into her performance appraisal, you know, how she communicates that, sets that up, everything, and it all goes back into the strategic plan and the matrix projects.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Jamie, this is Jim Waddell.
Hi, Jim.
On a similar vein of what Will was asking, maybe have you guys ever done a survey that basically, you know, conducted by a third party or something that looks at the work environment, do people feel like they're being optimized in terms of their skill and their time and they've got plenty to do or not enough or too much, you know, or all this kind of stuff, or what is the leadership competency that, and management competency of our folks and stuff like that? Have we ever done anything like that?
You know, I'm going back to, and Doug and maybe Nicole can help with this, there was an employee, I believe it was a satisfaction survey. I don't know that it, I can't remember the question specifically if it dealt into, you know, if employees felt like they had enough work. I do believe it asked some questions about your supervisor and your manager. But I don't remember what year that was conducted by communications, and I cannot remember when that was.
Yeah, that was a number of years ago, Jamie.
Mm-hmm.
So we haven't done that done that since now.
Yeah, in a while.
Now our KPIs, when you get right down to it, our KPIs are also a sign of productivity. Each of those 11 objectives are rated on all the things you've been seeing here in the last two meetings. And like this one that's up on the screen right now, the RP3 score, Jamie for her area, and matter of fact, this particular time, we all got 100%. Whereas in the past, we were lower, like 90, 92. So this is a kind of a score from American Public Power Association, looking at all 2,000 plus utilities, public utilities, and out of all of them, I can't recall the exact number, but there's like, say, 250 or so of them receive an RPC award. So we're from that standpoint, productivity in all four areas that they look at shows us in the top of all of them. As I think John reported last time that in Washington State, there was only three public utilities that received the diamond score that we received. So I think that's a good indicator also.
Hey, Doug, this is John. We've had two surveys conducted through Franklin Covey, one, I believe, in 2013, and one in 2017, I believe, that involved evaluation of supervisors and managers by employees.
Okay, from Franklin Covey, you're saying, John?
I believe so. Speed of Trust, and then we had the other one in 2017 where direct reports appraise their management. And there was a strong element on customer on employee satisfaction within those surveys.
Okay, yeah, those were training efforts too, so combination of both, yeah.
Yeah, John is right. We used that data that was collected by Franklin Covey to better assess ourselves and help us through the training. So
that's correct. Any other questions for Jamie?
I think we can move on. We've got time for probably one more, or do we?
Okay, we got Steve next here.
Okay, that should be quick.
Yep, it'll be quick. Let me share my screen here. Okay. Can you see that? 2020 second quarter KPI?
Not yet, Steve.
Well, where am I?
There you go. It says it's starting to share now. There we are. We got it now.
Okay. 2020 second quarter KPI for continuous performance improvement. This is basically district-wide. And what we do here, let me turn my video on. What we do here is we look at ways that we can continually improve our work in the utility. And the definition for this one quickly is continuously, incrementally improvement in everything we do, including strategic process improvement, innovation, and leveraging technological advances. And the picture of excellence that we're striving for is a culture where all employees continuously strive for new ways to improve and ways to improve and corporate technology information systems leverage for optimal use and performance. So on a 12-month rolling average, the KPI is 11, and as you can see down in the bottom, 10% or better is green, and that's why we're green. And these are some of the areas that we have identified as the big gaps to fill the point of excellence. I'm not going to go through every one of these and for time's sake, but you can see here, these everything that's in green are areas that we've been working on and that we've achieved individual areas to improve upon. The one down here in the red, in the black, number five, we continue to work on how people's work assignments and projects expand their capabilities and their competencies. But you can see improve, create a culture of continuous improvement, enhance employee recognition programs. And then we also have another five on this page, implement pursuit of excellence program, implement grid modernization meetings. This is our smart meter programs, our new software, NISC, and Laserfish software products. We've got the new employee self-serve. So all of these are areas where we're looking to improve efficiencies, basically. And that's why we have, out of everything we've scored ourselves, 11. We're looking at probably for next year when we meet and talk about strategic planning again, maybe generating a couple more KPIs based upon actual individual areas as opposed to just the general KPI of how many of these indicators we're fulfilling to make it a little more granular instead of such a high level view. But overall, these are all areas that we're striving to improve on a daily basis by using technology in all areas of the district. So, yep, that's basically that one. There we go. And that's the last slide. So, any questions?
Sounds like there's none, Steve. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, Will, it might be best to end it here. The next three are a little bit longer. Maybe if there's any customer questions now would be a good time.
Yeah. I'm not sure if Steve baffled us or whatever. I'm joking, Steve. Sorry. Okay, so we'll move on then. We'll defer any additional ones to our next meetings.
Okay, we've got next meeting we'll have Nicole's and Larry's, and then we have a risk management one too.
Okay, good. All right, action items for the board or for staff, from the board to staff. Did we capture anything?
Yeah, I think the one that Jim had asked about the solar, I think we'd come back with something on that, a presentation, you know, scope and analysis with respect to CETA legislation, potentially including solar with battery backup, distribution scale battery, small modular reactor, solar battery microgrid. So more on a very high level review of those systems.
Yeah, I think the operative word there is high level. You could burn a lot of staff time drilling down, and since it's projecting into the future, it'd be a bit suspect. So
right, it's a crystal ball.
Exactly. Okay. Next item is comments from the public. Sean, do we have anything?
Nothing from chat, but if anybody would like to make a comment, go ahead and give me your first name now, and I'll write you down.
Patty.
Richard.
Christine.
Okay, well, I heard Patty's name first.
Okay, Patty.
Just a suggestion. I have been speaking with a lot of community members, and the broadband is coming up a lot, and mostly in conversations where they're expecting PUD to pay for and install to the curb. And they're using other systems that are being deployed in other areas, which really are apples to oranges. But I haven't heard what a strategic plan is for broadband for PUD in some time. I know we had the deployment in SQUIM as a pilot project, but I haven't heard anything as to how that project's going, whether it's paying for itself or where it stands. And the other part of it is there was a federal project with millions of dollars that CenturyLink got years ago to build a backbone to Forks and around back through the back end of the West End back to Olympia, which was installed. But it was costly to provide service to any of the customers out on the West End. They could not afford what the costs were. So I would think, looking at federal grants, having done a lot of that work, there is no free money. There are costs, maintenance costs, ongoing costs. And I would think that the PUD should be looking at a strategic plan around what are they going to do. Are they going to try to deploy fiber to the West End, dark, backbone, whatever? But I think the citizens in the West End are looking for someone to provide to the curb. And I think there needs to be a strategy from PUD on just what are you doing, how much money you're really going to spend. Because if you get the grant, then what is it you're agreeing to do, and what ongoing costs are you going to incur?
Okay. Let me address that. Maybe Steve can.
I can too.
After yeah. I'm done here.
Yep.
I think to start off, Patty, I mean, quite honestly, our strategy up till, say, 3-4 months ago has been to provide our own system, basically to our, you know, substations, to our facilities, things like that. But it, recently, since this COVID, suddenly broadband has become really the thing, and everybody's been talking about broadband. And it's been, so it's not part of our strategic plan, for this year, because last year, it, you know, there wasn't anything necessarily that anybody was looking for or demanding at the time. You're right about that CenturyLink along the west end, that Steve can address that a little more. But I have been talking to Steve and Sean Delplane quite a bit about broadband is in the area now that people are interested in, and that we should be evaluating and look at it a lot more seriously. I think Steve can also address, you know, that, as you know, too, I believe, Patty, and everybody's listening, it's a major, major investment that we certainly would have to have grants in order to go forward with anything. Resource-wise, too, right now, we'd have to reevaluate that whole picture, too. So, Steve, why don't you add more to that if you'd like?
Well, I agree. Yes, Patty, you're right, and Doug is right. The fact that about 5 years ago, we decided that we were going to build our broadband infrastructure to service the needs of the district, and any excess capacity we would provide to the ISPs for customer use. That's been our plan, as Doug says, up until all of this hit. And so that's why we're going out for the grant, to try to see if we can get the funds to actually get to the West End. And you are right, CenturyLink did build the network up back around the backside of the mountains coming in from the other side. An interesting note there on CenturyLink, I'll just give you guys a quick update here. In the last board meeting, I did bring up the point that we were trying to put in some hotspots for two or three of the mobile home parks that were in Forks for the school district out there. And as we were moving forward on that, we had plans. We were moving forward on that. We got an email yesterday from the school district saying that now CenturyLink has finally stepped up and is offering services to all of those students out there, and they want to put our project on hold. So we're kind of doing that. We're kind of relying on the grant application to try to get the backbone all the way to Forks, like I was talking about a little while ago. It is very expensive. It all comes down to a matter of who's going to pay for it, if we have enough, you know, take rate to be able to try to pay some of this back. The payback is multiple years payback, and we'd have the other ratepayers subsidizing it. So that's some of the issues we have to contemplate, is do we make all the ratepayers, you know, subsidize getting all the way to Forks if we don't get a grant? Because in order to do that, we have to have crews to be able to maintain it. We all know how many trees fall down over the lines going in that direction. So it's definitely a need, but the costs are very high, and we just need to do some serious cost analysis to see if we don't get the grants, whether we even still want to try to pursue that goal. So that's kind of where we're at for that.
And I think that we would include a strategic project, at least, or look into a strategic plan in next year's 2021 strategic plan.
In the goals.
Goals. Also, Patty had asked about the pilot program in SQIM, which actually was happened before I even got here.
And before I got here.
Will could probably address that the most. It was not successful. I mean, we did what they asked us to do, and the way I understand it, Will, you can add in, there wasn't that many or none that really jumped on board and wanted to be part of it.
Yeah, I believe the take rate was in the teens of the number of people that actually signed up, and it's down in the low teens of how many people are actually using it today that have it available.
Yeah, I think the big impediment, Patty, you mentioned fiber to the curb, which, I mean, I guess you're talking about fiber to the home.
And the cost of doing that is tremendous. And the perception seems to be that, well, PUD should just do it. Well, you know, Grant tried to do that. Grant PUD tried to do that over a period of years, burned through all their reserves. Don't think they ever really accomplished to every home, and that was their commitment. The Squim pilot, the story we were told in the city of Squim and a number of groups thought that that area was going to evolve into mainly businesses, and that didn't happen. The area that was picked, people weren't willing to pay the cost of bringing fiber into their homes. And I think part of that was most of them probably didn't even have computers, but anyway, that was the story on that. And by the way, they constantly cite what Kitsap does. Well, Kitsap, fiber is their core business. And even there, what they're trying to do is, and I've been in sessions where they've talked about this, and so have you, Steve, that they're trying to form LIDs, LUDs, so that areas where you can get fiber to the home, but people will pay the cost of doing that through a local utility district. So, and
right.
Maybe that's something we need
Thank
to look
you.
At. Maybe that's something we should look at.
Okay, next up was Christine.
I just have a clarification. I think this is for Will. For the 2028 BPA contract, did you say those have to be signed by 2025?
That's the goal that BPA has set.
Okay, I just want to make sure I understood which contract you were talking about.
Well,
and then pardon me?
The terms of the contract would be available by the end of 2023, and they hope, or they're projecting, to have the contract signed by the end of 25.
Oh, so actually we only have, okay, that's interesting. And then for John, regarding the statistics, are there any statistics for the Squim EV station, like online? I know this is during COVID, so the statistics or the data wouldn't be, you know, wouldn't be stellar or anything, but do we have that available anywhere?
Yes, I believe we do. It is available on our external website, as far as I know, or at least that's what I understand. Nicole, can you confirm this?
I'm actually not sure who's tracking any statistics on it. What kind of statistics are you thinking?
Well, basically, we have a live production for kilowatt hours produced for each day and month and year going back that is, I believe, posted on our outside website. I think Sean or Colin set it up, but I have not used it in a while, so I would need to make sure it's still there.
I'd have to go take a look, too, but I didn't know if you meant, like, the numbers of unique visitors or anything like that. I don't think we're tracking, and I don't know if the city is tracking anything like that.
So what are we talking? Are we talking about production from the solar array, or are we talking about the number of visits to the charging station?
Production and usage. Production and
We have that on our outside website for production of kilowatt hours in almost real time, plus a history going back to the installation back at the end of September of last year, I believe.
Sean came down and loaded that up for me. So, yeah, it exists. So you need to just check with him, I think.
Thank you.
Richard was next.
Yes. Good afternoon. My question goes back to the last meeting about renewable energy credits. The question is, will we be buying renewable energy credits again this year? And if so, where do you go to find those now? And are there a lot of options? And then I'd like to follow that question, those questions up with a statement. And the statement is that I ran across SRECs, solar renewable energy credits. Some states, mainly in the East, are allowing local PUDs to buy RECs from solar producers. And the state of Washington is not included in that, by the way. So my statement is, gosh, wouldn't it be a good idea for Washington to get on the bandwagon with this idea so that our PUD could buy RECs from local producers, thereby enhancing the value of rooftop solar in our area. And that's my statement. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Richard.
I didn't have any others, Will.
Okay, we do not have a executive session. So if there's no other business to come before the commission, we stand adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.